Okay, thanks. So let me first start thanking Dan for the nice introduction he just gave to the main concept of my talk. And also I think I must acknowledge Dan because his work has been directive for a large part of our work. I'm an evolutionary biologist who uses the approach of experimental evolution, which you probably are familiar with, both with bacteria and with fungi, including yeast and multicellular fungi, to address basic questions about how evolution works. And I only relatively recently realized that the problem of antibiotic resistance is not only a problem, but also a career opportunity, when we started working with on the evolvability of TEM1 beta lactamase. That's familiar to many of you here. And that's a notorious player in antibiotic resistance. The work I'm going to present is work that was done by postdocs Marijn Salvada and Martijn Schenk. And a part of it was in close collaboration with Joachim Kroek and postdoc Ivan Sendra. Okay, so I'll have a very brief introduction. I won't say much about fitness landscapes, but here is one slide that shows it anyway. So this is to say that we become interested, particularly with this system, with this beta lactamase system, in two main determinants of evolution. And the first is the structure of fitness landscapes. And as Dan explained, it's the fitness map of sets of related genotypes that can be visualized usually in low dimensions, which is deceptive in some sense, but it also helps to explain general features about evolution. Its structure is determined by epistasis, as Dan just explained. And adaptation can be seen as a hill climbing process on this surface. Evolution can be seen as a walk across the surface, and natural selection, of course, drives populations up to higher peaks of higher fitness. And so I like to see this fitness landscape structure, the fitness landscape concept, as setting what is possible evolutionarily. The other main component or determinant of evolvability, so the ability of organisms to adapt and evolve, is our population dynamic parameters, like population size, mutation rate, recombination rate, which determine not only how much genetic variation is available for evolution, but also its short-term fate. For instance, population size, as you will see in the talk also, and as you know, determines the relative importance of drift and selection. Drift is overriding selection in small populations. But there's also this phenomenon of clonal interference, which comes back to the discussion about strong selection weak mutation regimes that happens indeed a lot in at least the microbial populations, and I'll show an example of that. Clonal interference, as you probably know, is this phenomenon that multiple beneficial clones are simultaneously present in asexual microbial populations and will compete among each other, and so the one with the highest fitness has the highest chance of fixation. And so population dynamics determine roughly what can be realized on the possibilities that are set by the fitness landscape. Okay, this is the system. This also needs very little introduction. I heard already at the introduction on Monday that several people work on this system. For those that do not know the system, I'll briefly say what it is. It's an enzyme that breaks down penicillins penicillins normally kill bacteria by disrupting the cell wall, as Dan Anderson explained Tuesday. And so this enzyme breaks down the beta lactam ring of these penicillins, which is this square here. It's one of the players in this so-called family of extended spectrum beta lactamases, TEM1. It's one of the ancestral alleles. And we use it to study adaptation to third generation cephalosporin cefotaxin, as most of the people I think that work with TEM1 beta lactamase, to which it has low but non-zero activity, the TEM1 allele, but it can increase its activity 1,000 or 100,000 fold by a whole array of mutations, as you will see. And so it's, I think, a good system for studying fitness landscapes and the role of the fitness landscape in determining mutational pathways that consist of multiple mutations. This is just to talk to the experimental evolution folks. So it has a number of benefits relative to the use of entire microbes. You can manipulate and control evolutionary parameters to a much extremer extent. For instance, you can use mutation rates that will never be bearable by living organisms. You can separate selection from mutation. You can use recombination by using restriction enzymes, and those kind of things. It's also very simple to sequence the gene, of course. The gene is 861 base pairs. So you can sequence this at any instance of evolution very rapidly and cheaply. And this, of course, helps enormously in understanding what is going on at the phenotype level. Okay, this is what I'd like to do, but let's see how far we get. I'd like to present a couple of recent and partly unpublished studies that we did with this enzyme on its evolvability that use roughly two different approaches. So the first two studies are more or less systematic explorations of small areas of the fitness landscape, where we make all possible combinations and look at the total number of beneficial mutations in this enzyme and their effects on phenotype. And one definition of fitness, as you will see, but this is certainly an important issue, how to translate resistance measures to fitness, and enter epistatic properties. So these are systematic explorations. The other two are more heuristic explorations across multiple rounds of mutation and selection of the role of the fitness landscape in determining the longer-term evolvability of this enzyme. And we're particularly interested, at least in the last study, in the effect of population size here. Okay, so let's go to the first study. The first study was a study that was done by postdoc Martijn Schenk, and here we were interested in quantifying the short-term evolvability of this enzyme by determining the total number of beneficial mutations, always in the presence of cefotaxime. So it's always this in the context of adaptation to cefotaxime. And their effects, the distribution of their effects on resistance and one measure of fitness, as I'll show. So what Martijn did was he used error-prone PCR to introduce mutations at a low rate, and then selected hundreds of mutants at low concentrations of cefotaxime. He quantified roughly in a very quick MYC assay their level of resistance. And then from each MYC category, he would sequence 36 isolates. And so this brought a total of more than 300 isolates. Among those 300, he found 52 unique mutations. And then he measured the resistance levels of these mutations, so their effect on resistance, with a quite sensitive assay that's different from the MYC assay that Bruce might like. It's an assay where we determined, where we looked at where we made survival curves. So we plated cells of that genotype on a whole series of concentrations of the antibiotic, and we determined the concentration where 1 in 10,000 cells would be able to produce a visible colony. So it's somewhat arbitrary, but it's a lot of work, but it appeared to be very reproducible. So that was the good thing. And now we have a kind of a simple and continuous measure of resistance that's different from the MYC assay, where you have these discrete measures that usually go up twofold each step. And so when he did this, and when we tested them with replication for their increase in fitness, we found, and did Bonferroni correction for multiple testing, we found that 48 of the 52 unique mutations had a beneficial effect on resistance to cefotaxime. The mutations occur across the gene, as you can see here, but they cluster around the catalytic site, which is shown in blue here, of the folded enzyme. So they particularly occur around that catalytic site, probably opening up this catalytic site because cefotaxime is bigger, I forgot to tell you, than penicillin. It has this bulky side group that was shown in red. And so they typically occur here. And interestingly, they include, the 48 includes 10 mutations that were synonymous mutations. So 10 mutations that did not change the amino acid sequence of the protein, which are shown in green here. We don't know why, but at the moment we're trying to understand how these synonymous mutations give an effect. It's not too surprising that they can have similar effects. Dan Anderson and Peter Lin, for instance, found for deleterious mutations somewhat similar results. We tried also to estimate the total number of beneficial mutations for resistance to cefotaxime. So that would include many of the small mutations that we had probably missed by plating on low concentrations of cefotaxime. And we did this by considering the relative frequency of the 48 unique ones among the more than 300 sequenced ones for each of the MYC categories.
Just a short question. So the beneficial, you mean in this cell assay, right?
That means increasing this IC99.99 measure.
So that's why you can have synonymous mutations, right? If the cells produce more or less of this protein based on...
Right, that's probably, yeah, so it's very likely that it has an effect on the dosage of the protein. But we don't know how exactly.
Can I?
Yeah.
Okay, where are we stopping?
Yes.
just too many very stupid questions. One is, what's the physiological substrate?
What's the physiological substrate?
Well, beta lactamase might
be
in this there will be some sense.
I'm not understanding your question.
What's the natural substrate of the enzyme?
The natural substrate is penicillin. It's an old enzyme. We don't know exactly its history. I think Dan Tuesday already said it's probably a penicillin binding protein originally, or it's derived from it, or similar to that. But it's very ancient. That's for sure.
So did you test against, so whether it loses its function?
No,
when it's
no, we did not. No, it's just adaptation to this new antibiotic that we tested. We did
so
some.
You said it might become sensitive to penicillin.
We've done some of that. So we've done some of the alleles that came out of particularly the evolution experiments that I'll later show. We tested those on ampicillin, and we found some negative effects, but many of those have no negative effect on the original, on the ampicillin substrate. So this gave us a maximum likelihood estimate of the total number of beneficial mutations of 87. So that 87 of the in total 2,583 possible point mutations, 861 times 3. Or 3.4% of all those point mutations apparently have a benefit in the presence of ciforadenant. And so this is high, but it's not unusually high. There's other recent studies that show estimates of the fraction of beneficial mutation between 1 and 10%.
Do you evaluate the effect on the drug-free environment?
Indeed.
Did you evaluate the effect?
No, we've not. No, but we have not looked at any costs yet.
Yeah. Can you expand a bit? I think that your measure of is better than MIC for uh-huh. But can you expand a bit on how you actually do that?
Do the assay?
Yeah, your assay, yeah.
So we played out on a series of concentrations of ciforadenant, again, twofold increases in concentrations. And we measured we played out a standard amount of cells, and we see how survival goes down. And survival is not really survival at the cell level, but it's the ability to produce from a single cell a visible colony. And this will become more important in the second slide that I'll show. And then we use just linear interpolation between the two concentrations that are on either side of 10 to the minus 4. And we determine where 10 to the minus 4.
So you do it like an MIC, but then look at the...
But it's not an MIC because we have a quantitative measure now per concentration.
But you have a series of concentrations.
Right.
And you have a series of wells that are now clear.
Yeah, Ecker surface.
You're asking how many cells are still viable in those at different concentrations. Okay, so you're sort of in a way you're also dealing with persistence.
Could be, yes.
Yeah, to some extent.
Yeah, could be.
But
in the MIC assay, you cannot tell how many were.
This is far better than MIC assay.
So here we count them, and it's. No. Yeah, it's even a bit more complicated, but I'll show. So then we got interested in. We wanted to know, the shape of the distribution of these beneficial mutations, and we used a statistical approach called the generalized Pareto distribution. Ivan Sandro did this. That can distinguish based on shape parameter kappa between three domains of distributions. Most of the evidence so far is for exponential-like distributions of beneficial mutations, which is in the Gumbel domain where kappa is zero. But there's two other domains. One domain has distributions with a truncated tail called the Weibull domain where kappa is negative. And there's the Fréchet domain with heavy tail distributions where kappa is positive. And when we did this for our measure for this IC99.99, this concentration of ciforadenant where 1 in 10,000 survived, we found clear evidence for a Fréchet-type distribution. So there were, apparently among the 48, there were mutations present that were exceptionally beneficial in terms of increasing this measure of resistance. Yeah?
Do you have the plot?
I don't have it here, but I can show you. But I'll show you another plot. Yeah, I don't have it here. It's in the paper. So.
But do they change by orders of magnitude, or do they change by...
They change not by orders of magnitude. Well, by... yeah, by one order of magnitude.
Now then it's cavitation. If most are of one order of magnitude, then three are 30 times higher.
Sure,
than
yeah. Exactly. So it depends, of course, on the measure that you have here.
Why do we care?
Huh?
Why do we care?
About this? I'll show you in a minute. but of course, we know, and we were aware of this, that resistance is not fitness. And so since we're lazy and the competition experiments did not work out in the first way we set these up, we thought of a kind of a lazy way to derive fitness from these survival data that we use to estimate resistance by modeling survival and reproduction per cell generation now as a branching process. So in the end, the ability of a single cell to produce a colony at a certain concentration of the antibiotic is, of course, an integral over many generations from one to, say, 100,000 cells where the colony becomes visible. And so this integrates over all these generations. And so what Ivan did was to try out a lot of... then we assumed that there was no effect of the antibiotic on the generation time. So generation time is constant. That's a very strong simplifying assumption. And that all the effect came from the probability of a cell to survive until the next generation, where it would produce two daughter cells. So where its Wrightian fitness would become two. So then the fitness per cell generation would be 2p. And we tried so many of these values of p that would match the fraction of cells that we found to produce a visible colony. Is this somewhat clear? I don't think I can better explain it.
But the competition experiments, you say, it's a lot of work, of course.
Yeah, not only, but they were erratic. So they went up and down.
So it was not orthogonal. I mean, your estimate of fitness based on this limiting and the pairwise competition were giving you different results in terms of...
No, they were erratic, so we could not get any reproducible results.
Okay.
So we think secondary mutations would pop up in the...
So even over the short term, you were dealing with secondary mutations.
But we haven't tried that very, very hard, so that's something we're looking into now again. But this seemed a solution that would at least give one measure of fitness within the context of this branching model that, of course, has to be tested further. But this gave values of fitness that I can show. They are here. For four different concentrations of the antibiotic, from low to high, where at least there was some survival of the wild type, otherwise we cannot express it as a relative fitness measure, relative to TEM1. And as you can see here, the estimates of kappa, all except the lowest concentration of cefotaxime show kappas that are still positive. So again, also here, the distribution of fitness effects within the context of this branching model were heavy-tailed. So there were some mutations had exceptionally large effect on the fitness, which of course is not too surprising because this is a monotonic function of the resistance measure that we had. So why is this interesting, to come to Richard's question? I think it's interesting because these exceptionally beneficial mutations, they may be expected to also contribute to evolution disproportionately, which means that the repeatability of evolution also goes up. And this is what was calculated here in this graph. So this is this P2 for the Fréchette type distribution that we found for these higher concentration of antibiotic, and it's compared to the exponential distribution that belongs to the Gumbel class, and particularly at high concentration of the antibiotic, the chances that two populations fix the same mutations go up. So this is one source of evolutionary predictability or repeatability, if you want. Okay, then on to the second study. This was again a project that Martijn did. Here we were interested then in how in the epistatic interactions that occurred among those 48 individually beneficial mutations that we had isolated. And so to address this, we analyzed two fitness landscapes, one based on all possible combinations of the four largest effect beneficial mutations that we found among their collection, and one based on four small effect, not the smallest, but small effect mutations that were quite small. And we constricted all 60 genotypes for each and measured again this IC99.99 measure of resistance. And here's one way to depict these fitness landscapes as a function, so where you see the increase in resistance on the y-axis as a function of the number of mutations that are involved in each landscape. And so lines connect genotypes that differ only a single mutation. And red lines clearly are cases of sign epistasis, because these are cases where the resistance goes down by the addition of a mutation that was beneficial in the original background, because this was the constraint of the analysis. And so you see a lot of sign epistasis going on in these landscapes. And here we compare it to the data that Dan got for the four mature protein mutations, so not the promoter mutation. And you see that the landscape is quite different. So in his case, the fourfold mutant had the highest resistance. In our case, combinations of two mutations were the ones that showed the highest level of resistance. So clearly stacking up mutations that are individually beneficial doesn't get you very far due to sign epistasis among those. I mean, in these two examples.
Excuse me, is this only this diminishing return story, or?
In a way, but this is a qualitative diminishing returns, right? Diminishing returns often means that there is magnitude epistasis, but this is clear sign epistasis.
Right.
So it goes down again. But it's somewhat similar, yes.
So wouldn't an interpretation be that, you know, once you fix the problem, there's no reason to fix it again? And if fixing it comes at a cost, then it could.
It's a diminishing return plus or minus.
Yeah, we don't know. So we've done one model that I'll show, but so far no clear clue, no big insights yet. Okay, so then we compared these three landscapes, so the two that we had produced based on individually beneficial mutations with Dan's landscape, for four measures of epistasis that had appeared in the literature, that measure epistasis in either locally, like the fraction of mutational pairs that show sign or reciprocal sign epistasis, or more globally, like the fraction of the total variation in resistance that's explained by all possible interactions. And this is the number of accessible pathways to the global optimum from its antipode, so it's four mutations away from it. And this is the roughness to slope ratio, which is somewhat similar to the F-sum method, but uses a Ruffman-Fuji model to derive the same thing. So what is shown is these roughness measures from low to high for the two landscapes that we made and that of Dan's, together with the expectation for a completely additive landscape that's shown here, this dashed line, and a maximally rugged or house of cards prediction of that ruggedness measure, based on random fitnesses of the genotypes that are involved in the landscape. So it's not really the absolute maximum ruggedness, but it's high ruggedness. So clearly, what you can see, there is a consistent ranking for these three models that are comparable in the sense that they all use beta lactamase, and funny enough, in Dan's landscape, two of the mutations are the same as in our large effect landscape, G238S and E104K. So there's a big overlap even. But clearly these differences are significant. Well, not in all individual cases, but the rank order at least is across these four measures. Yes?
So the single mutations that you have in common do the same effect?
Dan measured MIC, we measured this. This other measure. We did a translation to get them on the same scale.
So it's the same.
Yeah, it's certainly qualitatively, it's the same effect. Yeah. Sorry.
So did you also measure the MIC the regular way?
No, we did not. So we did. So we had for the large effect landscape, I think we did MIC and this other measure we did, and we estimated the correlation. There was a very high correlation. I forgot the coefficient. But we use that to linearly translate Dan's measure to our measure so that we could do it on the same scale. So two conclusions seem to be allowed, at least for this very small sample, of course. The first is that mutations that are only known for their individual benefits show more epistasis than mutations that are known for their collective benefit, because that's, oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, so, but Dan did, I think. So the set of the five mutations in his case, and including the four that we use here, came from a genotype which was known to have higher activity on ciprofloxacin. Clearly that shows less epistasis, as Boris already alluded to in the first hour. So in some sense, this is biased. So it survived the sieve of selection. While in our case, we were kind of, we didn't know what these combinations would do. And we would just stack them up and see how far it would go. Of course, our case is not to say that our case is unconstrained, because we constrain our data sets to mutations that are individually beneficial. Mm-hmm. And if you allow adaptation to go on, then also mutations that were originally deleterious can become beneficial. So both data sets are constrained, but there's this clear effect that we attribute to methodological bias. And then there's this other effect that within our two data sets, the large effect landscape seems to have more ruggedness than the small effect landscape. And this is consistent with data that are known for deleterious mutations, and also with a couple of models, including a model that Boris Pomir and Schreiman produced. So this may be an organizing principle in understanding effects of our patterns of epistasis among different systems. Okay, so where does all this epistasis come from? We have no idea. But we just started we started to do some experiments, and this is an earlier model approach to try to get at this that Ivan and Joachim were doing. So here the idea is, like in what Dan was showing at the end of his talk, to use a phenotype fitness model to ask the question, how much of the epistasis that we find within these data sets can be explained from the nonlinear mapping of resistance onto one or more underlying phenotypes of this enzyme. Of course, we don't know these phenotypes. They can be phantom phenotypes, as you said. We don't know what they are. But we asked this question, and for that, we tried a couple of models with one and more phenotypes. This is a model that Ivan tried that showed a relatively good fit. Which is a very simple model. It has two phenotypes. And the assumption is that on both of these phenotypes, mutations have additive effects. So there's no epistasis happening at the lower level of the phenotypes. And all the epistasis must come from the mapping of these phenotypes onto fitness. And that mapping is also very simple. Resistance depends asymptotically on each of these two phenotypes in an independent way. So there's no optima that can be overshoot, so that could cause sign epistasis. They slowly grow to the maximum level of resistance. To, of course, reduce the number of free parameters, we chose for one of the phenotypes tumor dynamic stability, which can be inferred with a routine called FOLX. And we calculated that for the mutants that we had. The other phenotype is indeed a phantom phenotype, which you can consider another key phenotype like activity of the enzyme, but we don't know. And we estimated this from the model fit. And we did this to the combined data of the large effect landscape with open symbols and the small effect landscape, so 31 genotypes, because the wild type is also present. The lines are lines of equal resistance, and they go from low in dark gray to high in that corner resistance. And as you can see, the model, this is the model fit. It nicely lines up all these data on this line here, showing that the model fits, the best model fit for this simple model requires that there are trade-offs between these two phenotypes, apparently. Increases in activity or whatever may increase resistance correlate with decreases in stability of the enzyme. And this is the quality of the fit, which seems reasonable. And so this suggests, at least, that very simple models like this can explain this strong sign epistasis that we found among these beneficial mutations in these two data sets. So this could be one source of explanation, at least.
So have you measured the levels of the M sign here?
We have not measured anything yet, but we're presently doing this. But we started with the synonymous mutations.
So does this say in the end it's only one independent phenotype?
No, because that model gave a really lousy fit.
Okay.
Then it should show from the single phenotype model, but that didn't fit very well.
But so if you plot this delta,
that's right. Like, yeah, but there's of course curvature.
It looks like that you can sort of express one in terms of the other.
Yeah, that's right. But there's still curvature. So this dashed line around this goes to some amplification that Joachim and Ivan made that show that it is certainly not linear. But on these scales, it does look linear. So there's some trade-off at a large scale, it looks like.
So you estimate delta J for each allele.
Yeah, with this full X routine.
And then you have a model that, I'm not quite sure how the Y coordinates come from the data.
They are, they are free parameters in the model, and they are estimated by the fit.
Okay, what's left over.
Yes, so the total model had 14 free parameters, and we have 31 genotypes, so. So it's a lot. So it's well, what can we do? We have to measure. Yeah.
Right, so if you look at the large infant mutations, they probably cluster around the active site of the protein. Or mm-hmm. if you look at the structure and where the large infant mutations, for example, cluster, and what would happen if you would mutate two of them at the same time?
Structural analysis are that's something we cannot do. We have done some structural analysis. Well, we did not, but then don't forget for our mutants. But that comes later, so I'll show. I don't show the structural analysis, but some earlier step in that analysis. But they are very complicated. That's a lot of. You should simply do this for 16 genotypes in a single landscape. That's too much work right now. Okay, so then some preliminary data on to address the question: how does epistasis affect adaptation in the end? So what happens when a mutation is selected with the identity of the new beneficial mutations? And this is another project that Martijn had started and that new postdoc Mark Schwert now will probably continue to do to finish. So what Martijn had done is now to kind of repeat the analysis that he did to select, to identify and isolate beneficial mutations as a first step, now in the presence of the biggest effect first step mutation, G238S. So he looked for, he again collected beneficial mutants, and he could find 35 that were beneficial in the presence of this big effect first step mutation. These new mutations are shown in blue here in the folded enzyme. Each cluster of balls is one amino acid. And the 48 or 47, so 48 minus G238S here in yellow, are shown in red. And the ones that are beneficial in the first step and in the second step are shown in pink. And clearly, if you would assume that the same 87, now 86, beneficial mutations that we estimated to be available for the first step, in the first step, would again be available in the second step, we would expect roughly 19 to overlap if you have a sample of 35. But we find that only 6 are found back. So clearly, epistasis affects the identity of beneficial mutations. And curiously, we didn't find any further synonymous mutations in the second step. So we found 10 in the first step, but no further in the second step. We're busy now with the third step, so hopefully that will give some more.
I guess the way you're finding these is affected by the selective, by how big a benefit there.
We try to bias against that. So we use a concentration that's just above the MIC of that genotype. So of the TEM1 genotype for the first step mutations and about this single mutant genotype for the second step. If you use a very low concentration, you just find the wild type back all of the time and you can. So you have to be sensitive.
So you adjust the concentration to the what was made.
Yes, exactly.
The second one, the first one.
So it's higher for the second step selection than for the first step selection, yes. Yeah. So again, we missed a lot, probably. Anyway, so this is just some preliminary data. Should we do, yes?
So among the second step mutations, they are all over the place, right? But the first step are...
Yeah, they seem to, that's right. They seem to cluster a bit more. Yeah.
They seem to cluster a bit more. Do you know what fraction of them is just sort of stabilizing the protein?
Yes, I kind of looked at that. I don't know by heart. No, I would have to look it up. Yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. Probably more than in the first step, I would think, because this G3DS is known to destabilize.
Mm-hmm. Do the assay for resistance and resistance all the time?
Yes.
Do you think it can change a lot if you do it
lower? We've done MIC assays at different temperatures, and typically it does not really affect the structure of the landscape, but it affects the level of resistance. And so we did a couple of temperatures for a simple MIC assay with a student project. And we found the, say, the level to vary quite a bit, but the total structure of the landscape didn't look very different. There were quantitative differences, but...
I guess I want to come to the question. So you're changing the amount of the antibiotic for when you're looking for these ones in mm-hmm. the background first.
Yes.
So then you're measuring their fitness back in the condition.
No, we measure fitness in the same way we did before. So just by estimating the concentration of the antibiotic, where 1 in 10,000 survive. So that shifts also. So it's just it's like a MIC assay.
Same definition. Right,
same definition. But you're further out on the scale.
You're finding them by one.
Yes.
By a different way, then.
But we screen them with the same assay. Or we measure their resistance with the same assay. Yes.
These second step ones, they're not like compensatory mutations, they're more like they're new resistance.
Sorry?
They're not sort of compensatory, as in they're not aiding in growth of the bacteria because they're improving the fitness within the growth rate of the bacteria. They're actually
right.
beneficial in terms of resistance. But you're kind of measuring a new resistance level, right, by increasing. So initially your experiments had low level antibiotic usage.
Right.
And now you're increasing the MIC, and now you're looking at a higher. So you might not expect. So much of an overlap because you're looking at a sort of like a new environment of antibiotics.
That's right, yeah. But this is the only feasible way in order to find new mutations.
But
then we test them again. We test them again with the same assay. So then we ask the question, how strong was their effect on resistance with the same assay we used in the first set.
So going back down to initial low levels.
So we use all these concentrations again and we see where they cut the line where 1 in 10,000 cells are able to produce a colony.
But if one says, okay, well, they can assume some parameterization like in Bruce's experiment.
Yeah.
So you assume some parameterization like that.
Uh-huh.
Then, depending on what that curve is, because the second ones have to have properties of several aspects of that curve. Right. So
right.
If you're finding one of them, but some other property of that curve or combination will determine whether you're actually finding
mm-hmm.
in this condition. And so it may be if that's just, you know, small enough on parameters that actually trying to fit rough loosely
mm-hmm.
that framework might be able to make sense.
Sure, yeah. It gives another layer of depth in some sense, but you would like to know, to understand then, say, all the parameters in the Hill function or in the...
I want to ask if I take a given first mutation word and ask what way does it change that function, then I can ask, okay, when do I expect that I will discover it on top of the second one, even if they were additive in some by some measure.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how the MIC values would relate to the different parameters in the Hill function.
But it isn't just the MIC parameter you're doing, because you're saying it has to do better than the first mutant under the conditions in which the first mutant is barely...
But we simply add a little bit more antibiotic and we see what we find. So it's then the ability to produce a colony on that in the presence of that new concentration. That goes back to your question, yeah. And so that, and we need to somehow enrich, and otherwise we keep on sequencing the same allele.
So about the non-synonymous mutations, what is the IC99 of this mutant that you took, and how many of the synonymous mutations that you had before actually had an IC that was below that?
All of them, because we took the biggest effect one. So we had to. So the second step was done in the presence of the biggest effect, the biggest of the 48 that we had collected in the first step. And the synonymous ones had significant benefit, but on average were significantly lower in benefit than the non-synonymous mutations. Yeah. Okay, so this is some other, so here we come back to the synonymous mutation. We recently made a landscape also of four of the 10 synonymous mutations. And here you see again the two landscapes of the non-synonymous mutations of large and small effect that I showed before. And here's the landscape of the synonymous mutations. So they're in the same order of magnitude as the non-synonymous small effect mutations, roughly, in terms of increasing resistance, as you can see on the y-axis. And although here the fourfold mutant is accessible. There is some accessible pathway from 10 to the fourfold synonymous mutant. There's also a lot of sign epistasis, as you see, even in this case. And so when we did the analysis again with the four epistasis measures, we found that it even has more ruggedness than these two non-synonymous landscapes. So there's much more epistasis. It cannot be explained by the simple model that I showed you with activity and stability, because it's hard to imagine how synonymous mutations will affect stability or activity of the enzyme, although but it's probably affecting at least the dosage of the enzyme. And presently, postdoc Mark Swart is now measuring expression levels as a first step towards some better understanding here. Do you have a question? No, okay. So lots of sign epistasis also among the synonymous mutations that we found. We expected this line to kind of continue down. Okay, so then,
just yes. Do you correct us for the effect size algebraically, the magnitude of the effect size of the large versus small mutations?
In these measures? In these ruggedness measures, you mean? Or
so the large spectrum mutations have a measurable effect, mm-hmm. and the small ones do too. So can that predict the level of effect stasis that you see?
Is
the observed effect stasis level just simply a function of the original?
No, it's not, because it's the same order of magnitude as the small non-synonymous mutations. See, the scale goes up. It's roughly similar. So it goes up to 1.5 roughly for both. So size effects do not seem to matter a lot. But anyway, in these measures, size effects are taken into account. This is certainly in this one, for instance, and certainly in this one, and I think in all. So I don't think that's an issue. Okay, then the final two studies that I'd like to show, which is work by Marijn Salvador, who set up the system in our lab as a PhD student some 10 years ago almost. In these last two studies, as I said, we were interested not to explore the fitness landscape in a very systematic way, but we were interested, at least not at first, we were interested in the evolvability across many rounds of mutation and selection of this enzyme, for which we used this protocol of in vitro evolution. Here you see the 10 gene sitting on a plasmid with like eye repressors, so we can use IPTG to kind of standardize the expression level, we think. We introduced mutations in the gene itself, so not its promoter. We only allow the gene itself to evolve. With error-prone PCR, normally mutation rates roughly 0.6. First we used some higher mutation rates. Then we ligated into the expression vector again and put them in E. coli, put them in a selection. So we grow them up, make copies of these libraries overnight by enrichment in the absence of the antibiotic, and then we put them in a whole series of concentrations of the antibiotic. And we take from the bottle with the highest concentration where we find growth, we take a single clone, sequence it, do a MYC assay. This was the early work where we used MIC as a proxy for fitness, and then we can continue with the next round of evolution. So each round of evolution fixes a single best allele. It goes through the bottleneck of a single genotype. So in the first study that Marijn did, we were interested in, say, the long-term evolvability of this enzyme, just on this lab to explore this landscape in a kind of broad way. And here we manipulated several parameters. We wanted to be very rigorous, so we did high and low mutation rates, no recombination with a restriction enzyme that roughly cut the gene after mutagenesis in the middle so that alleles could exchange fragments. But these manipulations that we did not appear to affect nor evolution at the phenotypic level nor at the genotypic level. And I think we understand roughly a bit how, although mutation rate could have a small effect. But I like to see this experiment as an experiment where 12 replicate lines were evolved under the same conditions. And so what you see here are the mutations, the only the non-synonymous ones are shown here across the gene, in red for mutations selected in the first generation, in orange in the second generation, yellow in the third generation, in the third round. So we did a three-round evolution experiment. And what is clearly conspicuous is a high level of parallel evolution. So most lines pick up this mutation, G238S, we've seen it before, in the first round, often combined with the stabilizing mutation, 182T, in the same or in the next round, and then followed by this other big effect mutation, E104K. So three of the four gene mutations that Dan also described in his, or studied in his landscape. But there's also two lines that conspicuously deviate from this pattern by having by lacking two of the three common line mutations, so the big effect first mutation and the last mutation, and at the same time having mutations at unique positions. And this got us interested in how would this be, why would this be? Why would there be, what would cause this divergence? And the hypothesis we got was that it could be driven by negative epistasis, sign epistasis perhaps even, between common pathway first step mutation, G238S, and an alternative first step mutation, which happened by chance in these two lines.
How big is the library you put into each of your 12?
Roughly a million.
And you said the mutation rate per base in your PCR?
Per gene is roughly 0.6.
And how many bases are there?
861. So all the single mutants can be assumed to be present.
Yeah, okay.
And clearly also double mutants and triple mutants are sometimes present and will be selected. So we got interested in whether this negative epistasis between this one and one of the red ones in these deviating lines would drive this divergence. And so we found candidates in both lines. This mutation that happened in the first round in this deviating line, R164S, was known to have negative interaction with G238S. And this mutation, A237T, in the other line, was suspected to have negative interaction with G238S. And so to test our hypothesis, we then ran a new evolution experiment where we build in these alternative first-step mutations, R164S and A237T. I did a new evolution experiment with five replicate lines, low mutation rate, no recombination, three rounds, and as the amino acid changes here show again, they did play a key role because none of these lines now got big effect mutation G238S. None of the R164S lines got the second common line mutation, and very few got the third common line mutation. While at the same time, there were mutations at new positions where the common lines had no mutations at position 240 and in the functionally important omega loop where the common lines also had no mutations. So clearly, there seemed to be some divergent effect going on that once, if you by accident fix this or this mutation before you fix this G238S, this big effect mutation, then you're driven in a different direction on the fitness landscape. So here you see the adaptive dynamics, the changes in MIC of these lines, and they confirm this view. Here you see the increase in MIC of the lines that start that follow the common pathway, so starting with G238S, so they reach high levels of resistance. And the alternative lines that start with these built-in alternative first-step mutations, despite their head start, because now they start with a beneficial mutation, they reach lower levels of resistance, as can be shown here. So this seems consistent with what we found in these small-scale, more systematic studies where we found all this sign epistasis. So also, if you allow all possible mutations to contribute to evolution in this error-prone PCR, and selection, we find that the fitness landscape of this enzyme is rugged for ceftriaxone resistant. It has probably multiple peaks, so at least it has this suggestive structure to have multiple peaks, and that initial mutations, which occur, well, depending on the regime by chance, are directive and determine the rest of the pathway. Yes.
So the error bars on this, are these measurement error bars, or
these are measurement error bars. Yeah.
So it's only one run.
No, yeah, but this is error across lines. These are 10 lines, these are 5, and these are 5.
So this is across replicates.
Across replicates. And of course, error bars, this is a discrete measure, so this is on the log scale, so we assumed that the log MIC was normally distributed for these standard errors.
You follow the nature in the antibiotic. And so the dynamics would be kind of interesting to know. Have you looked at the concentration of the antibiotic at the end?
No, we have no information on that at that front yet. That stuff we certainly also are interested in. But as I said, so we first do this now for the synonymous landscape. And we try to understand what's going on there. But we, and I'll show you some data for these mutations, that which comes up next. So this is what this is again asking the question, where does all this epistasis come from? And so this is another approach that we took, where we did actual biochemical measurements for the mutants that contained either big effect first mutation G238S or the alternative first step mutation R164S and the double mutant. And this was done by a PhD student of Dan Tofik at Weizmann in Israel. So here again, you see the sine epistasis that's happening at the level of resistance at MIC. Low resistance of the wild type, a whopping resistance of this big effect mutation G238S. A big effect also of this alternative first step mutation R164S, but really low resistance of the double mutant. So clearly showing the reciprocal sine epistasis in this combination. Yes.
Where are these things in the 3D structure?
Somewhere.
Okay. So
the one is they're on two different loops surrounding the pocket.
But so I mean, it seems like right if you had 238. To serine or 237 to threonine, so they will both provide a hydroxy group into the pocket probably. And the same is true for, so if the 164 would do the same, then it's also not surprising, right? And if you now have at two bulky things, that they will clash, and that's why it's structure-wise.
Sure, yeah. That's those kind of explanations would I buy. But this is what Dan and Einhard, the PhD student, have followed up now. And they've done structural analysis of these mutants. And this is now just submitted. But this shows that the mutation G238S is on one of these two loops surrounding the cavity. And it opens up the loop, but doesn't break many of the connections of that loop with other amino acids in the chain. R164S, though, opens the loop also, but removes, I think, five of the six bonds that exist between amino acids at that loop with other amino acids of the backbone structure, and so lead to kind of conformational chaos. That's the idea that Dan now has about this. This is
the R164.
Yes, that's a dead end in some sense, because it destabilizes the protein too much. Mm-hmm. It does open up the cavity so that the big antibiotic ciprofloxacin can now get in. So in that sense, it's beneficial as a first step, but there's probably very little. It has probably a very small dosage of correctly folded enzyme, mm-hmm. because it's having this conformational chaos or something. This is how far I understand it. I'm not a structure.
No? I mean, you still found it, so it must have.
It had a benefit. That's what we pick it up, and many others pick it up as well. And it has this benefit at the level of resistance. And so then we measured, three key properties of this enzyme: melting temperature, TM, kcat over km, so catalytic efficiency, and something that's called the cooperativity of folding, or M value, which is taken from the melting curves. It's the slope of the point of inflection of the melting curve, which shows how quickly it unfolds, which then the assumption is that if it unfolds very quickly, then it probably also folds very quickly on the ribosome, and that you have a high dosage of correctly folded enzyme. That's the assumption here. TM did not really vary between the four genotypes that we had. Catalytic efficiency showed the difference between the two single mutants in the correct order. So it showed that indeed G238S had a bigger effect than R164S, but did not show the lower functionality of the double mutant. But then when we combined it with the dosage, it seemed to be able to explain it at least at some qualitative level. So if you consider now mutations affecting these two enzyme properties together, we seem to, and if you zoom, of course, that they multiply, so that, say, protein fitness, or in this case, resistance measured in the bacteria will be proportional to the product of the dosage of correctly folded enzyme and the per capita catalytic efficiency of that enzyme, then we seem to be able to have some understanding here of the negative interaction.
Okay.
So what we're looking at on the right is the N value or dosage.
Yeah, so it's considered to be an estimate of dosage, and it's derived from this from these melting curves. By at the point of inflection of the melting curve, measured this slope, and the idea there is, as far as I understand, that the steeper the slope, so the more rapidly it unfolds, the more rapidly it will also fold on the ribosome, and which will affect its dosage in a positive way. Okay, then to the final study. This was again a project that Marijn did just before he left, and we're still analyzing some of this. So here we were interested in the effect of population size now. So we know the fitness landscape is rugged of this enzyme, and now we wanted to look at the interplay between structure of the fitness landscape and population dynamics, and we did this by tweaking with the population size, Marijn did. And so what we did was another evolution experiment where, again, we subjected big undiluted libraries of roughly 1 million transformants to selection. But we also had another treatment where we diluted the libraries, either 100-fold, 1,000-fold, or 10,000-fold, prior to selection. So meaning that that from the library that he made, from the error-prone PCR, he took 1%, 0.1, or 0.01%, put that under selection, so selected from those smaller pools of transformants. And then we decided, because we were not certain that we would dilute too much so that we would see no adaptation at all, we decided that we would continue with the maximal dilution, so with the smallest population of the three that we tested, where at least there was one mutation selected, so that we knew there was adaptation going on. And so we did this for four large populations and four small populations for four rounds of mutation and selection, and then we gave all eight populations two more rounds of undiluted evolution so that they could reach a local peak in the landscape. That was kind of the idea. So here are the mutations that we picked up in these lines for the large populations on the left and for the small populations on the right. Unique mutations are shown in gray, and parallel mutations that are used by more than one line are shown in color here. And clearly what you can see is that there is a much more diversity in the use of mutations in the small populations. So consistent with the idea that they're more, that there's less clonal interference and that it's more dependent on chance which mutation will be picked up at every generation. Particularly two mutations are very rigid in they occur in all four parallel, in all four large populations. All four start with G238S in the first round, this red one. Followed by E104K, always in the second round. And here the variation, as you can see, is much bigger. The white gaps are reversions or conversions, like in this case, it's a conversion from I to L and then from L to V, position 173. There's no difference, significant difference in the number of mutations that they use, but there is a difference in the initial number of mutations in the first round, where it's always one in the small populations and two to three in the for the undiluted libraries.
But the ones in the small populations, the ones that occur first, these are always big effect mutations?
Yes. What, in the small?
Yeah, in the small populations. Oh. These are belong to the biggest effect mutations.
This one is? Yeah, this one is. This one is. This one, I wouldn't know. It's probably, yeah, it's also among the bigger effect ones, yes.
So by population size, you mean bottleneck, really?
Yes.
And so you're looking at harmonic. And so what is this?
Well, there's no additional mutations happening during the selection process.
Right, but you're,
well, very little.
You're bottlenecking, so you're losing many as you... As
sure.
You, and so only the dominant ones make it.
But not only the dominant ones, the frequent ones, you can say. Or the, so you remove variation from the pool.
Yeah.
Taking.
But at the lowest dilution, what numbers are being transferred? Densities, I think.
So it's 1 in 10,000, so it means that it's in the order of a couple of hundred transformers. Yeah,
okay.
It's very small.
And so that biggest dilution is the one that you ended up sticking with?
No, it depended. So it varied every round.
Oh,
so we had this criterion that at least there should be one mutation.
See, yeah.
Otherwise, we would go one level up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it also vary with how long you grow them in culture for? Does it go through more generations?
What?
I guess I don't really understand what your selection is, but you put the plasmidated bacteria and then grow it up in culture and then streak it and pick
it? Yeah, then we grow it up in a series of cultures with increasing concentration of the antibiotic, and then from the highest concentration where we find living bacteria, we pick one.
Okay. Do you ever try varying the number of generations they can go through during that process?
The generations are defined by the rounds of evolution here, because we introduce mutations in vitro.
Yeah, but and then we select. A selection occurs during that growth up, though, doesn't it?
No, there's no selection in the growth up. There's only selection in the bottles with the antibiotics. In the growth up phase, there's no antibiotic.
Oh.
So we just make copies of the library, and then we add them to the bottles.
So a question about these mutations that you find, the ones that are not repeating, do you know that they are sort of compensating for doing the first?
No, we haven't really looked into this yet. Yeah.
Independently.
Yeah. But they are a large effect, yeah. You're right. I'd forgotten about that. At least three and probably four. But typically not always this one, the biggest one.
Aaron, do you know anything about the frequencies of the different types?
As they are produced by error-prone PCR?
No, like when you pick one colony, do you have a diversity of solutions?
We typically, yes, so we've done...
It must be, but how likely?
Yeah, so we do this in bottles of 50 mils, these bottles that I showed, the selection is happening in 50 mils, where we add roughly 10 to the 7 cells. So on average, we have 10 copies for each transformant. And they can then grow, I forgot to how many, but I think they can grow like 13 generations or something. So we then pick them 2 days later from that bottle. And when we do sequencing, we did 20, I remember, Moran did a couple of these things. 20, he sequenced 20 alleles that he picked up. It was in almost all cases homogeneous. So a single allele seemed to fix in many cases. But not always. In the next slide, I'll show you an example. So this was at the genotype level. This is at the level of resistance. So you see again the MYC doublings, now on the log scale, of all 8 populations across the 6 rounds of evolution, in red for the large populations, in blue for the small populations. And so there's 2 conspicuous differences between the large and small populations. One is that the large populations rapidly increase resistance in the first 2 rounds, and then they seem to level off. So after 2 rounds, they're all much more resistant than the small populations. And the small populations have a very different dynamic. They seem to have a more linear increase in resistance. The dip of this one is the reason is that we picked up a minority genotype here, because when we sequenced 20 alleles from these populations, we found that this one was only represented by 1 of the 20. So it was clearly a minority genotype, and also we found, you can see this in the previous slide, this one. So it had picked up this mutation, which was then reversed in the next round. So clearly it was a deleterious mutant that we had picked up by some, I don't know, maybe frequency dependent. So the reason it was still present in the population at low frequency, we picked it up, but it changed in the next round. So this is a freak accident. Maybe you should not take this into account too much. But the other interesting dynamic, of course, is where they end up after 6 rounds. And so clearly 2 of the 4 have now higher resistance than any of the 4 large population selection lines that we use, which all converge around this roughly 2 doublings up in MYC. So how can this be? How can we explain this effect of small populations, this positive effect on the evolvability of some of these small populations? This is a single allele. So the single allele, again, that we picked up after round 6, that we see, of which we know the genotype, we make it, and then we know the resistance.
Although in some ways, the last two
that's
are
right.
All undiluted.
They're all undiluted.
So we might like to look at round 4, but the
yeah, that's
still
right.
There.
Yes. Yeah, that's
right. It's already there.
Yeah, there is an effect there, but I'm not sure it's completely significant there. So I'm happy we did 6 rounds. but the question, of course, is how can this be? So we like this explanation. It's just one, and it still rambles a bit. But it's one that says that perhaps in small populations, where there is a greater impact of chance, some of these small populations may be able to locate higher peaks in a more efficient way than large populations. And this is what is shown in this cartoon by Andreas Handel and Danny Rosen for 2 large and a small population adapting to the same multi-peat fitness landscape. In large populations, of course, there are multiple beneficial mutations. They are represented by these arrows here. And we'll have this process of clonal interference, as I showed in the beginning. where there's multiple mutations, and now it becomes likely that the biggest effect beneficial mutation among those will win the competition. And so large populations are usually relatively to small populations, and it all, of course, depends on how big these differences are and on other conditions, are pushed up the nearest, steepest hill nearby, where they may or may not get stuck. That depends, of course, on the topography of the landscape. Small populations have fewer beneficial mutations, so there's less clonal interference. So it will depend more on chance which mutation will be fixed. And as a result, they will make smaller steps at first, but perhaps some of them will bring them in a position on the fitness landscape where they then do get access to the higher peak that's present. Of course, the main thing that's lacking now is we determined MIC and not fitness. And so what we now did was we did a competition experiment. We find a control one between the biggest effect and this one against, so paralyzed competitions between these four, again under the conditions under which we also did selection. So we did these competitions in this series of antibiotic concentrations, and we finally looked at the competition where we still found growth. So we had to do many, we had to start many, and then we picked them from the highest concentration. Yes?
How much bigger were the large populations than the small?
So between 100 and 10,000 fold, depending on which dilution we used to continue. And then the pairwise competitions between these four, and for this one, the highest MIC one, we find consistently that it outcompetes all four of these. So for this one, this scenario that I just sketched on this fitness landscape seems to be correct. For this one, the situation is more complex, and actually I couldn't find back the data that Moran had sent me recently, but there was a mixed blessing. I think it wins from two of the four, and then there was a draw with the two others, or something like that. At least it was not as clear.
Is this cherry-picked, or is this actual, you know, the full set of experiments that you
did? This is the full set of experiments. So there's four lines of large, four lines of small. That's how much we could handle, because we had all these dilutions that we had to check for the small small populations. Okay, so at least this scenario seems at least to have some credibility for one of the two small populations that produce this high resistant allele.
Well, if the z-axis were resistance, then it would be consistent with all
for both. Yes. Yeah. But there's no average effect, as you can see. There's no effect on average. There's effect in terms of heterogeneity. So the small populations adapt more heterogeneously, and some of them end up at higher levels of resistance than these large ones, which are more constrained by the structure of the fitness landscape, we think about.
There may be some similar things that happen with mutators and non-mutators. I mean, one of the puzzles in the Klinsky-Lonsdale experiments is that the mutators arise early on in some populations and not in others. But then if you look at as the fitness goes up, as they acquire more mutations, one would expect if things were even close to additive that the mutators would do substantially better. And they don't. They're all mixing together. You can't tell which of which by looking at the overall fitness increase. And so there may be effects there also somehow.
But there are several that fixed, right? Picking up there were several that fixed
the
also.
Mutators.
Yes.
But if you look at the fitness of the populations, the mutated populations are not systematically doing better than the non-mutated.
That's right, yeah.
And you would expect them to. Mm-hmm. And so some effects which are analogous to this, maybe the ones, the mutations that the mutators pick up earlier on.
Oh, that's interesting.
May
I never
open
really,
up your opportunity. They may also make it less, the mutators may also make the population less diverse from those mutations, which can also have that effect. Because in some particular directions, maybe you find where the smaller effect initial mutations were.
Well, they found this kind of this secondary selection for evolvability in one of the population without a mutator, I believe, where the lower, so where they looked at one time point where they found two clones with different fitness, and then they looked at a later time point and they found that the ones that produced offspring for the later time point was the one with the lower fitness, which apparently higher evolvability, which they showed experimentally independently from.
But the general one, because the population has strength and diversity in them. The mutated versus non-mutated.
You okay, Rich?
Their generality is certainly in terms of the rate of evolution. As far as the level that they reach, I think that seems more arbitrary from these data. I mean, you can say that it is interesting that, you know, too small end up higher than MIC than then they're mostly the large, but then too small end up with lower MICs.
Right. So there's no average effect.
Yeah, so there's no...
And it's low numbers, as you said. This is how far... I mean, I'd love to crank this level of replication up, but that's infeasible right now.
If you go to even larger population sizes, would you expect to go... that they can then climb back up?
That's a very good question. No, it goes down again. Joachim showed this on another rugged fitness landscape that we had produced for a fungus. And there he showed that the rate of at least repeatability, which is consistent with what we find for these large populations in comparison to the small ones, it goes up if you increase population size to a certain point when you go into clone interference. If you increase it even further, so that double and triple mutants become dominant in driving the dynamics, then repeatability goes down again. Because now you get this whole new realm of possible pathways that opens up by population that can jump fitness values. First, you are constrained by following, say, the more or less swim regime with clonal interference, and then they are allowed to spread out their possibilities under natural selection again. That's the idea. Or is that not what you mean?
No, it was.
Okay.
So in these experiments, you have the term gene on a plasmid, right?
Yes.
So how do you control for, I mean, for many plasmids, the copy number of those is dependent on the growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
So your dosage might be varying depending on how much you restrict growth. So I was thinking about the competition experiments,
In the competition experiments. Oh, that's interesting.
Because that's something, I think you have to control for.
In the others?
It might be dampening your effects. But as they grow smaller, your copy number of the plasmid probably grows up. It depends on which plasmid it is.
It's a 10 copy number plasmid.
Yeah, and that could kind of dampen your effects.
Yeah, we're analyzing it now for a number of in vivo lines. Where we have allowed the enzyme on the plasmid to evolve in the bacterium. But so in the megacase, this doesn't play a role because we always put them back in an A factor, an A host, and every round we do. Okay, maybe I should finish with the summary. So we've seen that that when we screen for the number of beneficial mutations in this enzyme in the presence of ciprofloxacin, that roughly 3% provided the benefit, including synonymous mutations, and a couple of exceptionally beneficial ones that produces a heavy tail of this distribution. When we started combining these mutations, we found a lot of sign epistasis, particularly among these sets that we had constructed where we had used individually beneficial mutations. And also, if their effects were large, the effects were stronger. But then again, the data set on synonymous mutations seems to screw up this pattern again. So we don't know whether that will extend. And of course, this is only a very small data set, so. We showed with the phenotype fitness model, or phenotype resistance model, we showed that a very simple model with subtle nonlinearities in the dependence on resistance on underlying phenotypes could already explain this very high level of ruggedness in these landscapes that we had analyzed. So from that mapping, that mapping will already be sufficient to explain that. Then we encountered a couple of factors that contribute to parallel evolution, which is a particular interest that we have, so in terms of predictability of evolution. Of course, there's these mutations with exceptional benefits that contribute disproportionately, this Fréchet-type distribution. There's aesthetic constraints, although so it will limit the number of pathways, as Dan nicely showed in the introduction. Although I think if you would, the relationship between epistasis and parallel evolution is not very clear. If you would allow all possible mutations to contribute, back and forth mutations, and so I don't know how that relationship is, but at first it certainly looked like epistasis will constrain the number of possibilities and will increase parallel evolution, and then large population size, although it is non-monotonic, so if you go even higher, then repeatability goes down again. We've seen with the second and now third step beneficial mutations that clearly epistasis affects the identity of beneficial mutation and so restricts mutational pathways. Of course, we don't know yet, although there's a growing number of data sets. Just recently, Michael Desai had a beautiful new set in yeast that shows that there is diminishing returns epistasis, although nobody really understands where that comes from. My intuition is that it comes from some physiological homeostasis that is reached in the cell, and that this gives a kind of a temporary ceiling to fitness. But clearly, this can be broken. It's not a hard constraint. And then we also showed in the final experiment that chance events in small populations can be important for evolvability. How general this is, of course, we have no idea. And okay, we'll certainly follow this up. This is one of our main interests. So this is finally all the people that have contributed to the work. The ones on the left I mentioned, these are people that have contributed to parts of the work. So thanks, and let me know if you have questions.
A lot of questions got asked, and I'd really like to encourage the students, so I don't think I've been asking as many questions as some of the rest of us. We can encourage, you know, give them a few minutes to
think of a question.
The back. and another thing, maybe to stimulate you, I can offer a bottle of wine.
For the first question?
Yeah, well, yeah, sure.
I was going to do the best one
for a week. Not make it so easy, but
the best question.
Okay, let's go.
Okay.
So I like the cartoon where you sort of put the difference between small population and large population, and the idea being that small populations might be able to climb the staircase and go in directions as opposed to
right.
the nearest tower. But presumably if you made the large population even larger, you wouldn't have enough time to jump.
Exactly. Yeah, that's also my that would be my my intuition. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, if these landscapes are shifting constantly, I mean, in this experiment, constantly, in a real sort of clinical setting,
yeah.
these are all shifting up and down a lot. So, I mean, what do you think is more advantageous, being small or large, when the landscape's changing?
I think so. If the environment is structured with respect to the selective agents, antibiotic, then small populations also do better. There has been some work. With microfluidics, I remember a paper in Science. Maybe even people involved are here, where heterogeneous conditions were implanted on a chip, and then evolution appeared to be to lead much faster to higher levels of resistance than in a homogeneous environment, which is a bit similar to say a population with many small genes where drift is more important. Right, so that certainly alludes to the effects that we find by the simple comparison of small and large populations. Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. Yeah.
Why, if you're doing this with random mutagenesis, why do you still focus on a single gene? Why not do genome-wide thing and measure the effort? Because I mean, the effort stasis genome-wide is what matters for the bacteria when it's really evolving.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's what we're doing. But it's much more work. So we have an experiment where we have 72 small populations and 24 large populations evolved for 500 generations in the presence of increasing concentration of ciprotaxin, where we allow all possible copy number variations and gene rearrangements and duplications and losses and to happen. And we did full genome sequencing, and the last batch, I think he just got back, so Martijn is now still analyzing that. That's one thing. But of course, we can only do it within the financial and time constraints that we have. Yeah?
I would just like to advocate a little bit for large populations, because
you feel they are underrepresented.
Now, right, so if you have small populations, right, of course, right, crazy things happen, right? So the problem with small populations is they tend to die.
Small population.
So, right. So, you know, you can reach very, you know, exotic states of the fitness landscape, right?
Before they die.
But maybe they die before that, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, if you kept the dilutions constant, they would all die. So, yeah. How relevant this is, right, to a clinical setting in which the immune system is not as nice as you and says, oh wait, we should be a little bit.
I see your point. Yeah. I think it's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, of course. That's what all these people doing rescue experiments look at. What are kind of minimal population sizes that can survive a certain level of stress evolutionarily. I feel we should stop it here, right? No. Yeah? Thanks.